Blog Talk Radio.
Arose from dew, and the divine divine fluid that magically appeared at dawn. And they also correctly believed that Amantia to be the fruit of the tree and referred to them as such. Amantia is the great sacred mushroom.
Mm.
So we're going to go to that video. It's about 9 minutes, but it might be an interesting one to talk about. And it's about regarding the penal gland. How people...
Why the truth and information about this knowledge has been a well-guarded secret of the priest class for a great many years. The symbol of the all-seeing eye has always been a part of Earth's creation mythologies and mysteries. In ancient Egypt and in the modern-day dollar bill, it is symbolized by the Eye of Horus, or the all-seeing eye. The symbol was passed down through the ancient mystery teachings of Babylon to be found on the American dollar bill. Why the symbol of the eye? The eye is the observer of reality, or the illusion of reality. In the physical body, your eyes look outward, so it views objects upside down and extends the message of what it observes to the brain, which interprets the image and makes it appear right side up to us. But the human body has another physical eye, whose function has long been recognized by humanity. It is called the third eye, which in reality is the pineal gland. It is the spiritual third eye, our inner vision. It is considered the seat of the soul. It is located in the geometric center of the cranium. The pineal gland is about the size of a grain of rice. It is in the center of the brain. It is located in the geometric center in the brain as well. It is located directly behind the eyes, attached to the third ventricle. The true function of this mysterious gland has long been contemplated by philosophers and spiritual adepts. Ancient Greeks believed the pineal gland to be our connection into the realms of thought. Descartes called it the seat of the soul. This gland is activated by light, and it controls the various biorhythms of the body. It works in harmony with the hypothalamus gland, which directs the body's thirst, hunger, sexual desire, and the biological clock that determines our aging process. When the pineal gland awakens, one feels a pressure at the base of the brain. This pressure will often be experienced when connecting to higher frequency. A head injury can also activate the third eye pineal gland. While the physiological function of the pineal gland has been unknown until recent times, mystical traditions and esoteric schools have long known this area in the middle of the brain to be the connecting link between the physical and spiritual worlds. Considered the most powerful and highest source of ethereal energy available to humans, the pineal gland has always been important in initiating supernatural powers. Development of psychic talents has been closely associated with this organ of higher vision. The pineal gland contains a complete map of the visual field of the eyes. It plays significant roles in human functioning. With the pineal gland being a pine cone-shaped gland, we'll now take a look at some of the symbology of pine cones throughout the world, symbolizing the third eye and the attainment and the restriction also of knowledge. Nature of reality. This symbol is an in-your-face reminder of the restriction of knowledge and the power of keeping mankind in a state of arrested development through the withholding of pineal gland information, thus keeping us from knowing the true nature of reality through providing us with false religions. Dimethyltryptamine is a substance produced by the pineal gland that is believed to facilitate the traveling of the human soul in and out of the body. The human body is flooded with this substance at birth and at death, and also the 13th week of gestation of a newborn child, coinciding with the Tibetan Book of the Dead, what it refers to as the exact time when a soul can incarnate in a new body on earth. DMT has been associated with near-death experiences and shamanistic travels into the spirit world by its ability to take a person's soul into non-material realms of reality. Strange enough, DMT also has a cone shape when magnified underneath a microscope. Clinical studies of DMT have shown patients to contact alien and reptilian-like creatures who claim to be waiting for them during these experiences. Shamans have used ayahuasca, which contains DMT, to communicate with their quote-unquote gods for centuries. While science doesn't officially claim to know what DMT is actually for, research into dimethyltryptamine will show that this substance produced by the third eye allows a glimpse into realms beyond our 3D world. Buddhist monks spend lifetimes to know this power, and there is more to know on DMT than we have time to cover here. So please look into dimethyltryptamine, DMT, for yourself. Another interesting connection to the pineal gland is Sirius. Often referred to as the portal to Sirius, it appears that this knowledge of the pineal gland and DMT was known by the priest class of the Egyptians as well as by the priest class of today. You will find reference to both the pine cone and Sirius to be important elements of the Freemasonic system. The star Sirius is commonly known as the dog star, and the dog is associated with the 13th Kabbalistic pathway of Gimel and is the guardian of the threshold. The dog is also that of the ancient Egyptians and their god Anubis. Anubis is the lord of mummification and is also associated with the death trance, which seems interestingly related to dimethyltryptamine or DMT. The dog is also used by the Greeks as the three-headed dog of the underworld known as Cerberus. And now Dr. John Dee's Chronozon of the Enochian Magical System, who is the intelligence of the Veil of the Abyss. The dog also represents the mammalian brain of the cerebellum, which resides atop the reptilian brainstem and is the headquarters for the autonomic nervous system. Between the hemispheres of the cerebellum, one will find the vestigial eye of the pineal gland. There is much more to know about the pineal gland, dimethyltryptamine, and Sirius than we have time to cover in this short video. But I hope you will use this as a springboard for your own research and as a tool to enlighten others on the true nature of our reality of illusion.
We, for those of you listening tonight, George Dixon passed away this weekend.
Last week.
And we had a funeral for him on Monday. And George and I and Lila on Friday nights we often talked about things like this.
Yeah, he would have enjoyed talking about that.
And this and the pineal gland, George and I have talked about it for a number of years and how it created the, it is the gateway, if you will, to the next dimension. And you know, there are a number of sources to do that, and of course the mushroom, the sacred mushroom, Amanthia muculus, and marijuana is another gateway. But these have been proven to be gateways to that fourth dimensional area. And this is what this talks about, actually, that particular video, which was entitled Multifaceted Magic Mushroom and the Pine Cone.
Reality of illusion. That's what it said on the...
Right, reality of the illusion.
Oh, this is interesting. Whose game,
yeah,
whose city?
Yeah.
UK protest is to face corporate Olympics. Let's read that.
I thought it was a good one. And another one is, the next one we'll see is JP Morgan. $14 billion a year in subsidies from the U.S. Sons of bitches. And so.
Who was this put out by?
This is put out
Press TV.
No.
No?
Okay.
British campaigners are to hold a demonstration on the doorstep of the 2012 Olympic Games to protest the government's turning of the Games into a showcase for corporate, financial, and military power at a time people are crushed by sweeping austerity measures. The umbrella organization, Counter Olympics Network, or CON, has organized the protest planned between Mile End and Victoria Park in East London on the second day of the Games on July 28th in what another anti-game hub. Our Olympics hopes to become the greatest act of nonviolent civil disobedience of our time. Khan said the Games have been organized by an arrogant elite of Korea politicians and millionaires who have spent $12 billion of taxpayer money to broadcast their vision of a neo-liberal world run by the corporations and the rich. Our rulers have turned the London 2012 Olympics a showcase for class privilege, corporate power, and their so-called war on terror concept, while cutting welfare, privatizing the National NHS, National Health Service, bailing out the banks. They plan to use the Games to trumpet the message that austerity Britain is content and open for business, it added. The London Olympic Games are centered at Olympic Park in East London and will be held between July 27th and August 12th. The Games have been plagued with embarrassing revelations about its sponsors. The Independent reported earlier this month that the German sportswear manufacturer, which is given the contract for making the clothing of the London 2012 Olympics, has been slaving Indonesian workers. The paper said that the clothing are being manufactured for Adidas in sweatshop conditions in Indonesia, making a mockery of claims by London 2012 organizers that this summer's games will be the most ethical ever. The report revealed workers at 9 Indonesian factories Adidas is using to produce Olympic shoes and clothing have been working up to 65 hours a week for a tiny
35 cents an hour, or shoe an hour.
0.35 pounds an hour, whatever that is. I don't know what that is. That's a pound sign. Meanwhile, Amnesty International rapped the government earlier this week for accepting American chemical giant Dow Chemical as the sponsor for the 7 million pound decorative wrap that will sheathe London's Olympic Stadium. Dow Chemical faces a $1.1 billion compensation lawsuit by the Indian Supreme Court over the Bhopal gas leak disaster in India. Dow Chemical, a sponsor of this year's Olympic Games, owns the company responsible for the Bhopal gas leak, which killed 7 to 10,000 people immediately and a further 15,000 in the following 20 years, Amnesty International said. But Dow has never addressed the ongoing human rights impact of the catastrophe it caused, the human rights group added. This comes as the chairman of the London Olympic Organizing Committee, Sebastian Coe, is now at the center of investigations of allegations that he was involved in selling Olympic tickets on the black market for profit in more than 50 countries. I mean, what a sleazebag. The allegations against Coe are also at the center of the Counter Olympics Network campaign for their protest. We do not consent to austerity, privilege, and profiteering. We reject Prime Minister David Cameron and Coe's corporate Games concept.
Boycott the Games.
Yeah.
Boycott the damn
thing. I don't even want to watch them.
I won't. I don't think I will.
Followed by the Jubilee, preceded by the Jubilee. I couldn't watch that stuff. That nauseated me.
Oh, the Jubilee was absolutely disgusting. England should be neutered. It is neutered. They have a ridiculous, what do we call it? The 2012
Olympics. Leo is putting something on Facebook here. He's sending
this
article.
We've got the 2012 Olympics. I think everybody should boycott them and make them.
Watch it on TV.
Don't watch
either.
It. They're going to complete and utter failure. Here's another one. J.P. Morgan Chase gets $14 billion per year in government subsidy. Can you imagine that, folks?
No.
And last year,
go to the article.
Yeah, go to the article. But you know, through $14 billion a year subsidy from our government, and they've stolen all of these trillions of dollars. I mean, what is going on, folks? What, this is from
Liberty. No.
No, it's from
the trenchesworldreport.com.
Yeah. So it turns out that J.P. Morgan Chase gets $14 billion per year in government subsidy. CEO Jamie Dimon and his presidential cufflinks do not care for your questions about the bank's government subsidy. At least some of the billions of dollars that J.P. Morgan Chase lost gambling on credit derivatives once belonged to you. Well, last week, Senator Jeff Merkley, a Democrat of Oregon, had the gall to spoil the Senate Banking Committee Gentile grooming of J.P. Morgan CEO Jamie Dimon by pointing out that his bank would not still be in existence without taxpayer assistance. Outraged by Merkley's impunity, Dimon roared that his bank only took the government's lousy bailout money and only borrowed at rock-bottom interest rates for the Federal Reserve because the government insisted that they do so for the sake of appearances and the good of the country. And J.P. Morgan and the country's greatest hero, so it had no choice but to accept all of its free money the government was handing out. It certainly did not need it. What Dimon did not say, however, is that J.P. Morgan continues to get loads of free government money, particularly $14 billion per year, according to the number crunching by Bloomberg, based on an International Monetary Fund study. Bloomberg editors write, "The money helps the bank pay big salaries and bonuses. More important, it distorts markets, fueling crises such as the recent subprime lending disaster and the sovereign debt debacle that is now threatening to destroy the euro and sink the global economy." $14 billion. That's a lot of cufflinks. The number is based on an IMF estimate of the benefit J.P. Morgan gets in bond markets from the assumption that the government will make J.P. Morgan's creditors whole in the event of another financial catastrophe. The IMF figures that the banks pay out 0.8 percentage points less in interest to borrow and compare with ordinary mortal banks that have the misfortune of not being too big to fail. The lower interest rates translate into about $76 billion a year for the 18 biggest U.S. banks, Bloomberg writes, of which J.P. Morgan shares is $14 billion. Fun fact, that $76 billion is more than enough to pay for the $30 billion in extended unemployment benefits that's set to expire at the end of the year, but who's counting aside from the unemployed? I mean, this figure does not include the $12 billion windfall J.P. Morgan and other big banks are expected to get from the government HARP refinancing program, which, again, J.P. Morgan is only
taking advantage
of
for the good
of the country. Lots of people, mainly Congress people and Wall Street people, wonder why anybody would care at all about J.P. Morgan losing an estimated $3 billion to $7 billion in gambling and risky derivatives. The bank makes way more than that in profits, and its bank's God-given right to lose money on risky derivatives is that what it sets its mind to doing. Expect to hear more of that and more of Dimon's angry cries that his bank is so ward of the state.
There's no ward of the state,
but Dimon appears more before the House Financial Service Committee later on Tuesday. This subsidy is one good reason of many why people should maybe care. This is a taxpayer money they're gambling with. And so, you know, folks, This is a freaking piece of, you know, piece of a crack company here. You know, J.P. Morgan. J.P. Morgan.
Leo's posting this
Diamond.
One
thing. What's his name? Diamond.
Jamie Diamond.
Diamond is a...
He's a ward of the government.
And Jamie Dimon are wards of the U.S. government.
Since we pay for everything.
Yeah. There you go, folks. So, you know, I mean, if this does shit doesn't make you sick, I don't know what does. But you know I don't know. I'm getting this stuff off of the David Icke website, by the way, which I really love. And
he has a lot of good things.
Here's a 1 minute thing on. I don't know if anybody ever saw Spartacus. It says I am Spartacus. I'm gonna play that just for a minute. It's only a minute.
Yeah.
Let's see.
I bring a message from your master, Marcus Licinius Crassus, commander of Italy. By command of his most merciful excellency, your lives are to be spared. Slaves you were, and slaves you remain, but the terrible penalty of crucifixion has been set aside on the single condition that you identify the body or the living person of the slave called Spartacus. I'm Spartacus.
I'm Spartacus.
I'm Spartacus.
I'm Spartacus.
I'm Spartacus.
Overthrowing the corrupt government, they've drafted a constitution
that will stop this from happening ever again. That's not the best part. The best part is that they've had arrested all Rothschild Rockefeller banking puppets responsible for the country's economic chaos and meltdown. Last week, 9 people were arrested in London and Reykjavik for their possible responsibility for Iceland's financial collapse in 2008, a deep crisis which developed into an unprecedented public reaction that is changing the country's direction. It has been a revolution without weapons in Iceland, the country that hosts the world's oldest democracy since 930, and whose citizens have managed to effect change by going on demonstrations and banging pots and pans. Why have the rest of the Western countries not heard about it? Pressure from Icelandic citizens has managed not only to bring down a government, but also begin the drafting of a new constitution in process and is seeking to put in jail those bankers responsible for the financial crises in the country. As the saying goes, if you ask for things politely, it's much easier to get them. The quiet revolution process has its origins in 2008 when the Icelandic government decided to nationalize the 3 largest banks, Landsbanki, Kaupthing, and Getnir, whose clients were mainly British and North and South American. After the state took over the official currency, the official currency krona plummeted, and the stock market suspended its activity after a 76% collapse. Iceland was becoming bankrupt, and to save the situation, the International Monetary Fund injected U.S. $2 billion. And the Nordic countries helped with another $2,500 million.
$2.5 billion.
Yeah. Great little victories of ordinary people. While the banks and local and foreign authorities were desperately seeking economic solutions, the Icelandic people took to the streets and their persistent daily demonstrations outside Parliament in Reykjavik prompted the resignation of the conservative Prime Minister Geir H. Hardy and his entire government. Citizens demanded, in addition, to convene early elections, and they succeeded. In April, a coalition government was elected formed by the Social Democratic Alliance and the Left Green Movement, headed by a new Prime Minister, Jóhanna Sigurðardóttir. I guess.
Oh, that was good of you to say that. I couldn't imagine how to pronounce that.
Sigurðardóttir.
Throughout 2009, the Icelandic economy continued to be in a precarious situation at the end of the year, and the GDP had dropped by 7%. But despite this, the parliament proposed to repay the debt to Britain and the Netherlands with a payment of 3.5 million euros. 3,500 million euros, which is 3 billion, a sum to be paid every month by Icelandic families for 15 years at 5.5% interest.
Oh, my God.
The move sparked anger against the Icelanders, again, in the Icelanders, who returned to the streets demanding that at least that decision was to put to a referendum. Another big, small victory for the street protests. In March 2010, that vote was held, and an overwhelming 93% of the population refused to pay the debt by less than those conditions.
At least with those conditions.
Yeah. This forced the creditors to rethink the deal and improve it, offering 3% interest and payment over 37 years. Not even that was enough. The current president, on seeing the parliament approve the agreement by a narrow margin, decided last month not to approve it, and called on the Icelandic people to vote in a referendum so that they would have the last word. The bankers are fleeing in fear.
Oh, bet.
Returning to the tense situation in 2010, while the Icelanders were refusing to pay a debt incurred by financial sharks without consultation, the coalition government had launched an investigation to determine legal responsibilities for the fatal economic crisis and had already arrested several bankers and top executives closely linked to the high-risk operations. I love these guys. Interpol, meanwhile, had issued an international arrest warrant against Sigurður
Where is that?
In our arson.
In
arson. Yeah, former president Sigurdur, of one of the
Sigurdur,
banks.
In arson.
Yeah. This situation led scared bankers and executives to leave the country en masse. In this context of crisis, an assembly was elected to draft a new constitution that would reflect the lessons learned and replace the current ones inspired by the Danish constitution. To do this, instead of calling experts and politicians, Iceland decided to appeal directly to the people, and after all, they had sovereign power over the law, and more than 500 Icelanders presented themselves as candidates to participate in this exercise in direct democracy and write a new constitution. 25 of them, without party affiliations, including lawyers, students, journalists, farmers, and trade unions represented, were elected. And among other developments, this constitution will call for the protection, like no other, of freedom of information and the expression in the so-called Icelandic Modern Media Initiative, in a bill that aims to make the country a safe haven for investigative journalism and freedom of information, where sources, journalists, and internet providers that host new reports are protected. And the people, for once, will decide the future of the country, while bankers and politicians witness the transformation of a nation from the sidelines. And God, I wish we could do that here.
Yeah, wouldn't that
if we could only do that here. But, you know, the problem is that goddamn Americans, you know...
Well, Iceland's a very small country, too.
Well, no, but,
it's
it's manageable, but you could manage it here. I mean, instead of 25 guys, you have 250 guys. What the hell? You got 465 morons doing nothing.
Yeah.
Let's re-elect them all, okay, re-elect everybody, throw everybody the hell out, and start a new government. What's wrong with that? Criminalize all the bankers, stop the military crap, destroy all of these sons of bitches that are destroying our country. You know, change foreign policy, do all this. But, you know, we won't, because this country is too freaking, you know, bullshit. Just the bullshit. We're full of slaves, and we're full of mediocre.
Do we have another audio that we could play?
I'm sorry.
Oh, marijuana contains.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, it said CNN
lies.
Yeah, lies saying marijuana contains 70% more cancer-causing agents than cigarettes.
Well, we know that's
not true. What a fucking
lie!
Because marijuana has proven to be a cancer cure. All right. This is funny. CNN, what a joke of a station. And you wonder why they're raising.
And fewer teens are smoking cigarettes, according to a new study by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. But more teens are smoking marijuana, which contains as much as 70% more cancer-causing agents than tobacco smoke. The study of 15,000 high school students found 18% had smoked a cigarette in the last month, compared to 23% who smoked pot. And Cuban boxing legend.
So, you see, folks, it's a lie, because we've played stuff on this show that has shown that cannabis and cannabinoids have proven to be cure cancer, okay?
Yeah.
And that those people that people that smoke marijuana and smoke cigarettes have a 50% less chance of lung problems. Let's see. Oh, yeah. This is a good one, too. Obama gives away oil-rich islands to Russia.
Imagine
islands
that. Off Alaska?
Yeah, imagine this son of a bitch giving away this. You know, I hate this man. I hate Obama. I can't help it.
He's just such a whore.
I hate Romney also, but I hate Obama. I mean, I can't vote in this election. It's absurd to vote in this election. What do you vote for? For people you hate? Both parties?
And this is from WND Opinion.
Yeah. Hang on one second here. It
takes a minute for it to come up, folks. Oh, I guess the picture's not coming in.
Oh, come on.
There it is.
Okay. Obama giveaway. Oil-rich islands to Russia. The coming of Jesus. You think you know the Bible? I don't know what that is.
Oh, that must be an ad.
Yeah. Well, the Obama administration, despite the nation's economic woes, effectively killed the job-producing Keystone Pipeline last month. and the Arab Spring is turning the oil production of Libya and the other Arab nations over to the Muslim Brotherhood. Or Iraq is distancing itself from the U.S., and everyone recognizes that Iran, whose crude supplies are critical for the European economy, will do anything it can to frustrate America's strategic interests. In the face of all this, Obama insists on cutting back U.S. oil potential with outrageous restrictions. Part of Obama's apparent war against U.S. energy independence includes a foreign aid program that directly threatens my state's sovereign territory. I don't know which state he is.
Alaska.
Obama's State Department is giving away 7 strategic resource-laden Alaskan islands to the Russians. Yes, to the Putin regime and the Kremlin. The 7 endangered
islands. The State Department has undertaken the giveaway.
The 7 endangered islands in the Arctic Ocean and Barrack Sea include one of the size of Rhode Island and Delaware combined.
Wow.
The Russians are also to get the tens of thousands of square miles of oil-rich seabeds surrounding the islands, and the Department of Interior estimates billions of barrels of oil are at stake.
The State Department has undertaken the giveaway in the guise of a maritime boundary agreement between Alaska and Siberia. Astonishingly, our federal government itself drew the line to put the 7 Alaskan islands on the Russian side. But as an executive agreement, it could be reversed with the stroke of a pen by President Obama or Secretary Clinton. The agreement was negotiated in total secrecy. The state of Alaska was not allowed to participate in negotiations, nor was the public given any opportunity for comment. This is despite the fact that the Alaska legislature has passed resolutions of opposition, but the State Department doesn't seem to care. The imperiled Arctic Ocean islands include Wrangell, Bennett, Jeannette, and Henrietta. Wrangell became American in 1881 with the landing of the U.S. Marine ship Thomas Corwin. The landing party included the famed naturalist John Muir. It is a 3,000 square mile in size. Northwest Wrangell are the DeLonghi Islands, named for George Washington DeLong, the captain of the USS Jeannette. Also in 1881, he discovered and claimed these 3 islands for the United States. He named them for the voyage co-sponsor, New York City newspaper publisher, James Gordon Bennett. The ship's crew received the hero's welcome back in Washington, and Congress awarded them gold medals. In the Bering Sea, at the far west end of the Aleutian chain of the Cooper Island, Sea Lion Rock and Sea Otter Rock. They were ceded to the U.S. in Seward's 1867 treaty with Russia. Now is the time for the Obama administration to stand up for U.S. and Alaskan rights and invaluable resources. The State Department's maritime agreement is a loser and gives us nothing in return for giving up Alaskan sovereign territory and invaluable resources. We won the Cold War and should start acting like it. The Obama administration must stop the giveaway immediately.
So,
this is an addendum. This is not a new issue. In fact, Bush and Clinton administrations are directly at fault for the same inaction. A maritime agreement negotiated by the U.S. State Department set the Russian boundaries on the other side of the disputed islands, but no treaty has ratified this action. Consequently, it is within the president's power to stop this giveaway. The Alaska delegation failure to put pressure on the administration is inexplicable. State Department Watch, an organization that assisted with this article, has confronted each administration and is currently confronting the Obama administration and has been met with silence. I am hoping this piece will help reinvigorate efforts to stop this handover.
What a sick deal. What a really sick deal. Sorry, folks, but you know, I'm just totally blown away by this. You know, blown away. Sorry. Obama gives away
islands off Alaska.
What
Scott Garfer admits there was no Obama family.
What's this?
Right here.
Oh, interesting. Okay. We'll go to another great article. It appears that there never was an Obama family. Let's see if this actually plays. Oops. It's probably been censored from the internet. Sometimes the internet censors itself. You know, these articles get censored by things. Okay, a biographer admits there was no Obama family. Oh my God.
This is from
Jack Gashel, an Emmy Award-winning independent writer and producer with a PhD in American Studies from Purdue. Facebook blockbuster Deconstructing Obama. Mariana's new book, Barack Obama and the Story, the chattering classes seem to have overlooked the most insignificant of Mariana's revelations, namely the story of which Obama based his 2008 candidacy is received myth, not the truth. My parents shared not only an improbable love, but Obama famously
said Obama famously in 2004 Democratic Convention keynote. They shared an abiding faith in the possibilities of this nation. This concept of multicultural romance shaped his persona and his campaign. At the 2008 Democratic Convention in Denver, Obama leaped into the story in the very first sentence. 4 years ago, he began, I stood before you and told you my story of the brief union between a young man from Kenya and a young woman from Kansas who weren't well off or well known, but shared a belief that in America their son could achieve whatever he put his mind to. As Mara Annis concedes, these two young people shared very close to nothing. In the college life of Barack Obama in 1961 and 1962, writes Mara Annis, as recounted by his friends and acquaintances in Honolulu, there was no Ann, there was no baby.
Although Mariana's talked to many of Obama's senior friends. Wait a minute.
Senior's friends.
Where did I go here?
None.
None of the credible ones ever so much as saw him with Obama's mother, Ann Dunham. One Obama friend, a Cambodian named Kiri Teet, knew the senior Obama very well. He had also met Ann through a different channel, but he had no idea, writes Morales, that Ann knew Obama, let alone got pregnant by him, married him, and had a son with him. Only a white governor, Neil Abercrombie, claims to have seen the pair together during the presumed courtship stage, but he is not close to credible. Maybe I'm the only one in the country, Abercrombie told the Los Angeles Times in December 2010, that could look you right in the eye right now and tell you, I was here when that baby was born. This was pure lie. No other word for it. Wow.
A few days later, Abercrombie clarified to Mark Neese of the Associated Press that he didn't exactly see Obama's parents with their newborn son at the hospital, but that he remembers seeing Obama as a child with his parents at social events, another lie. Mariana should have quoted Abercrombie with the stated qualifier that he proved unreliable on all things Obama, but he did not. Abercrombie was too important. Without Abercrombie, there is no to any contemporary witness to any kind of relationship. Mariana, however, knew enough not to quote Abercrombie on his claims to having seen the baby with his parents.
Despite his Herculean digging into the dung of Obama's life, Mariana's shovels come up empty on the couple's alleged February 1961 wedding. He footnotes his comments closely. Marriage facts recorded in divorce records. This is no doubt that both Ann Dunn and Obama claimed a wedding. It suited both their purposes, Obama to extend his visa and Dunham to legitimize her baby with a black husband. As to the divorce, Dunham, as at this time, was desperately trying to keep her future husband,
Lolo
Sotoro, in the country. The INS believed her to be married to Obama. Even if she was, even if she were not married, a divorce would have been useful to clear the way for a marriage to Sotoro. Like other biographers of either Obama or his parents, Marianas is totally silent on Dunham's whereabouts from the February marriage to the August birth. He adds one detail, however, that deepens the mystery. According to the birth certificate and newspaper announcements, the young family lived at 6085 Kalaoninole Highway.
Kalinioli.
Where Dunham's parents lived. Obama Sr. clarified to the INS that mother and baby lived there without him.
Where are you reading?
Marianas. No, right here. Right there.
Okay.
Marianas definitely states that Dunham and Obama and the infant never lived at 608 Kalalona. There was no room. The senior Dunham shared the house with the Pratt family. The Pratt daughter has no memory of the Dunham's daughter bringing an infant home. And yes, finally, an Obama biographer admits that the blogosphere has known for the last 4 years. Within a month of the day Barry came home from the hospital, he and his mother were long gone from Honolulu back on the mainland.
This period, Washington State revisited Marianas writes, is missing from the memoir the son would write decades later. In fact, as recently as Father's Day 2012, Obama was claiming that his father left home when he was two. What Marianas does not say is that he missed the Seattle Hegria story himself in the 10,000-word Washington Post article he wrote on the eve of the 2008 election. He was hardly unique. No one in the mainstream media wanted to blow the whistle on the fraudulent family fable that got Obama elected president. The New Yorker's David Remick chose to overlook it in his 2010 Obama bio. The New York Times' Janie Scott overlooked it in her 2011 bio of Obama's mother. The Boston Globe's Sally Jacobs overlooked it in her 2011 bio of Obama's father. And the Times' Jody Cantor overlooked it in her 2012 book on the whole extended family.
Worse, conservative writer Dinesh D'Souza chose not to report the fraud in his disingenuous bestseller, The Roots of Obama's Rage. As D'Souza explains, Obama was his father's son. Dunham's served largely as the vehicle through which the absent Obama exercised his will on the young Obama. She being Obama Sr.'s first convert to anti-colonialism. D'Souza should have known this was nonsense, and conservative writer Michael Patrick Leahy had broken the Seattle story as early as 2008 in his book, What Does Obama Believe? It was accepted knowledge in the conservative blogosphere by 2009. And what Marianas had laid bare, perhaps without meaning to, is a journalistic scandal of historic proportions in which, alas, himself has played a part.
Hmm.
And it's really fascinating that Obama is such a freaking shill.
Fraud.
And, you know,
he's not a shill, he's a fraud.
I'm looking forward to, you know, I'm supporting Trump's, Trump is going after him in a big way. And
I thought he gave that up.
No, he's still going after him. Obama is a fraud. There you go. I just posted that to Facebook too, folks. But you know, it just overwhelms me, you know, that we have to, that we've been so lied to. You know. Unbelievable. We are so lied to. Last night, I was thinking of reading this.
No, we've talked about that.
Okay. You think so?
Yes, I do.
You really think so?
U.S. and Russia start visa war. What's that?
I don't know, but it's 11 minutes and we haven't got that much time.
The invisible thread that pulls apart DNA causing genetic disorders and cancer.
Let's read that.
Electromagnetic radiation.
Yep. So let me read that.
We only have about 5 more minutes, so.
I'll take that one. So, anyway, that's
from
natural
news.
The invisible threat that pulls apart DNA causing genetic disorders and cancer.
We are all exposed to electromagnetic radiation constantly on a daily basis from mobile phones, Wi-Fi hotspots, power lines, and electrical appliances. The sources of this pollution are many and varied, each having its own range of wavelength, frequency, and intensity. How does the artificial electromagnetic soup that we bathe in every day affect our precious gift, our DNA? Our DNA is a polar molecule which is affected by charged particles and electromagnetic fields much the same way as other polar molecules. Put simply, a polar molecule such as water has predominantly negative and positive regions. The charges on the molecule will align itself with the direction of an electromagnetic field. When the field oscillates, the molecule will switch from one direction to the other, resulting in increased temperature. This is essentially the working of the microwave oven. The issue with DNA, however, is not merely one of increasing temperature. Many studies into mobile phone frequency, EM radiation, have only studied the heating effects. Whilst heating of the brain does occur, this is not the only cause of concern. The internal components of the DNA structure are rotated at different frequencies and different weights, and the external ribbons of deoxyribose and phosphate are rotated and pulled, unzipping DNA. With so many differing EM fields being transmitted by so many different sources, the DNA components attempt to turn to align with their respective fields. This causes rotational and tensile stresses on the molecule. The base pairs of the molecule are held down by the middle by a weak hydrogen bond, much the same as a zipper. These weak hydrogen bonds are used in replication, but are weak enough to be broken by physical stresses put on the structure of the molecule. The result is damaged DNA structures that are unable to function the way they are designed to do so. Damaged DNA results in many diseases such as genetic disorders, infertility, and cancer.
The many studies into mobile phones use and overhead power lines have come to different conclusions depending on who has carried out the studies. However, some results are universally proven. DNA is damaged by EM radiation, or electromagnetic radiation. Heating of the brain occurs when a mobile phone is used, and cases of cancer have been observed in areas of the body consistently exposed to mobile phone frequency radiation, meaning the ear and the side of the head. Despite evidence of the dangers, the use of EM devices is still rapidly on the increase. With smart meters, Wi-Fi, and more powerful next-generation mobile communications, this is in addition to the already numerous sources from electrical appliances, TV and radio signals, body scanners, overhead power lines, and even the wiring in the walls of your home. There is no doubt that more research needed to be done, but whilst the dangers are ignored in the search for profit, no amount of research will change the daily onslaught of the silent and invisible danger. So there you go, folks. And we're at the end of our program, and we thank you so much for joining us. And we ask you to please join us tomorrow night with me, and please join us Friday night
with our tribute
show, with our tribute to George Dixon. We have a number of guests joining us, and those who are listening tonight are invited to call in, and if you know George or want to say something, please do.
Or if you're invited just to listen.
Just to
that'd
listen.
That would be great.
So,
and I hope you have a good evening, folks.
And thanks for joining us. And join us tomorrow night and Friday night.